slightly more than a decade of independence, South Sudan has already endured the devastation and trauma of a civil war, which was followed by a shaky peace agreement that continues to loom over the heads of more than 11 million South Sudanese, yearning for any semblance of stability. One continuity that prevails, all the way from its pre-independence period, is the centralization of revenue from the extraction of natural resources. The failure to equitably distribute those spoils, giving us a big part of the story behind South Sudan's endemic poverty. In this episode, we go through the research, evidence from our experts to understand how local communities in South Sudan relate to, and in some cases manage, the exploitation of natural resources in their country. Welcome to the debut episode of the Conflict Zone podcast from the London School of Economics with me, Malik Banat. Together, we explore the changing nature of global conflict in the 21st century by taking a closer look at the causes and drivers of war and intractable violence. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power producing violent conflict, and how long-term sustainable peacemaking strategies can address these seemingly chronic problems. This series of Conflict Zone is produced by PeaceRep, an international research project exploring the changing nature of conflict, peace, and transition processes in the contemporary world. PeaceRep is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. The information and views set out in this podcast are those of our experts, and nothing herein constitutes the views of the FCDO. For today's conversation, I am happy to welcome Dr. Matthew Benson, who is the research director at the LSE-CCRG's Sudan program, as well as his fellow colleague based in South Sudan, our very own Rose Mabu from the Bridge Network. Before we dive right in, Matthew, would you like to introduce yourself and maybe tell us more about the framework of the Sudan program at the LSE?
So the Conflict and Civicness Research Group is a group that is led by Professor Mary Caldor, and it contains a variety of people who all work on countries such as Ukraine, Syria, Somalia, Afghanistan, and in my case, I lead the Sudan and South Sudan research stream. The thing that sets us apart is that we're really extremely invested. We're not traditional academics who study conflict. One, we're a mix of different disciplines. I'm a historian, others are anthropologists. Some people are political scientists or specialists in international relations. We're very interdisciplinary. Another thing that sets us apart is actually that we work extremely closely with local research networks on the ground. That is what makes our work especially sort of immediate and makes it very powerful. And it also gives us a sense of that we're really speaking for more than just a kind of an elite vision of how things work or one that's out of touch with what dynamics are. It is the Bridge Network in South Sudan. And the Bridge Network is something that we developed through an initial collaboration with other LSE scholars and also myself. And they've now become an independent organization on the ground, working with a range of different organizations. Oftentimes it's with us, but it also includes other academic collaborations with other universities, as well as UN agencies and these kind of things. Their ambition is to actually become the preeminent research organization within South Sudan, and we're doing our very best to support that. Everyone in that research network, which is very large at this point, it's I believe it's around 30 people or a broad range of backgrounds, and they're actually members of the communities in which they're often conducting research, and they're actually from a range of different parts of South Sudan. They're not just from one region. So that is what the Conflict and Civicness Research Group is, otherwise known as the CCRG. And ultimately, we're a mix of kind of scholar activists. We're extremely interested in producing world-class academic research. We are at the LSE for a reason. But we're also extremely interested in seeing our ideas shape the world, which is also part of LSE's broader mission. And I would say we're often at the forefront of that.
And I think it is really inspiring to hear about how wide the network of people you work with is, including researchers physically present in South Sudan like Rose, our other guest on the podcast, from whom we will hear very soon. In the meantime, Matthew, in the past you have studied and analyzed in depth South Sudan's tax collection system. In your paper, you go as far back as 1899, the beginning of British colonialism in present-day South Sudan, to essentially conclude that taxes were and continue to be a tool for the self-enrichment of elites rather than something that leads to the improvement in living standards overall. And whether taxes were collected as a purely colonial practice used to maintain loyalty of specific actors or indeed sponsor rebel movements, groups. It all reflects the predatory outcomes, despite maybe different groups benefiting from the system at different times. Now, when we speak about the pushback against these practices among the public, it is often cited that South Sudan underperforms when it comes to expressing discontent through the conventional channels of civil society mobilization. Would you agree with this assessment? Is there something here that speaks on the lack of agency among South Sudanese people?
I'd say it's not totally accurate. I'd say that there's a tremendous amount of agency that South Sudanese people have exercised in order to avoid or extricate themselves from coercive political logics, which you described. The most prominent example would be, I mean, if we look back in history, we'll see the Tory Mutiny, which took place in 1955, and it was a precursor to the decades-long civil war, which led to South Sudanese independence. So there's a longstanding sense that if things are unjust or if there's not accurate political representation, either of people who would like to be part of government or actually economic considerations, that there people will push back. There has been violence that has been used as part of that. So I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a lack of agency. It's more how do these forms emerge in ways that are peaceful or violent. If we fast forward to post-independence decades, so from 2011 into the present, just over a decade of independence, there is a concern that there's a lack of civil society or discourse and these kind of things. But that is very different than saying that there's a lack of civicness, which we define as the kind of alternative to the political marketplace. And what this means is that people actually have very clear ideas about how government ought to work, how citizenship ought to work. And these are actually challenging the pervasive political economy dynamics, which Alex de Wahl's thesis of the political marketplace encapsulates. And so this means that it's not just about civil society, but actually it also ties into who is within government. There are elements of government which are actually very open to different ways of doing things that challenge the overarching political economy. And more than that, there are also local forms of this, which we particularly see with customary authorities. So this would be people like, and for the most part, this will be individuals such as chiefs, but there will be other forms of customary authority around. Women's groups, there are labor groups, there are all types of different ways that people are organizing themselves in order to create a more fair South Sudan.
And if I understand correctly, you are currently focusing on how local communities, through the extraction of natural resources, are directly or indirectly challenging this prevailing logic of the political economy you mentioned. Tell us more about what you have discovered so far.
So there's a few examples that emerged through the research that myself, Joe Greenbaum at the University of California, Berkeley, and Jimmy Iwane, who is from the Bridge Network in South Sudan, found in our research. The first actually emerged through an independent project or a project that was a precursor to this one, where I was on the border, South Sudan's border with the Democratic Republic of Congo in a place called Yambio, which is in Western Equatoria. And I was with a researcher and we found out that some members of the community there were actually very unwilling to have gold be extracted or what they called gold. It turns out that gold in vernacular terms can actually mean a variety of different minerals when we dug deeper into what that is. But the overarching story here is that people were actually very reluctant to dig up the gold or whatever resources were there unless they were sure it was going to be shared more equitably within the region which was being mined. So that was the real kind of seed for this project, was sort of seeing that there were seeming to be at least an imagination or concrete examples of ways that people were actively trying to move against these coercive political marketplace dynamics, which Alex Wall describes. I found this to be very moving and very important, especially as we think through what could be a broader decarbonization of South Sudan. And what we mean by decarbonization in the South Sudanese context is that as present oil fields exist, there are ideas that perhaps the country is actually going to exploit those by the end of 2030, if not before. Now, there may still be other oil fields that exist, And so the country may still continue to exploit them. But even if that happens, the world is rapidly decarbonizing. And there are lots of questions about what this means for countries such as South Sudan, where a lot of the world's natural resources are, as the world decarbonizes, actually needs to depend more on, where there are things like lithium needed for batteries and other types of natural resources, not necessarily coming from South Sudan, but from the continent as a whole. So South Sudan provides one example of how a country may decarbonize and what might that mean for the broader political economy. So other examples that exist are actually tied to timber. There's a lot of illicit or suspected to be illicit timber trade that's taking place. And this also includes things like charcoal and so forth. And you actually see really interesting dynamics emerging where communities are actually working with military groups that are in the area. So these could be armed actors or soldiers. One prominent example emerged in Eastern Equatoria where the community was actually had created a kind of NGO or a monitoring group, which explicitly sought to kind of crack down on or illicit timber extraction. And so the problem with this is, or some of the fragilities of this is, it's not a perfect mechanism because it did turn out that when armed groups or when men with guns emerge, it is very difficult to enforce these mechanisms. But at the same time, there are these local forms of community resistance or certainly civicness emerging where people are trying to challenge or prevent the mismanagement of resources. Some of the other examples that emerge from our research actually draw upon vernacular forms of knowledge, which tie to how people understand their community relationship to the area in which they are these things are taking place. So this emerged with mining, fishing, timber in particular. Anyway, there's all types of stories that emerge, or even folklore that's used in order to describe people's relationship to the natural environment. And this could invoke things like mystical snakes or frogs the size of a house that had gold in its mouth and needed to be protected from foreigners who would take it. And the same thing with serpents that would actually protect mining areas and prevent illicit extraction. So there is this overarching narrative that emerges from these popular stories or fables or however you want to call them or describe them, where people have a real clear idea that doesn't necessarily derive from a sort of robust, you don't have to know political theory to know this, to understand these things, but there is this broad political understanding or this popular understanding of this complicated relationship with the natural environment, the need to protect it against these outside incursions, and also this changing boundary between what is the local area. So as these discussions were emerging, a lot of questions emerged around or took shape around what is community and what is a local community and who are, because you're not necessarily just fending against outsiders from, say, wealthy multinational corporations. You're actually in many instances, if not all of them, actually fending off against elites who are coming from Juba, the national capital, who are doing their best to sort of capture these resources. And in many cases have already started to show signs of being able to do that, whether that's controlling the different roadblocks that exist, and sort of creating a real elaborate market for timber and these kind of things, or at least benefiting from the movement of these goods into neighboring countries such as Uganda. Or this could even involve suspected monopolization of these kind of different shipping mechanisms and kind of and so on. So there are local efforts that are taking place. That those are some of the more prominent ones, but they draw upon quite surprising modes of community resistance with these shared stories that some may call folklore, some may call cosmologies, but certainly there's different narratives of how people ought to protect the natural world and also the awareness that it's fast depleting. There are forests which are people can literally see them sort of being eradicated. And yet people really depend on these forests and so on for their livelihoods. And you also see a gender dimension taking shape, which was quite surprising, particularly in the timber sector, where women who may be widowed or have limited economic opportunities are actually playing a much larger role and are viewed as really trusted individuals to be able to sell and obtain timber and charcoal and these kind of things. So there's a lot of shifts taking place, in part because of waves of conflict that emerge and displacement, which have emerged not just in the recent violence that emerged in the past decade, but also decades of displacement before then. South Sudan civil wars were extremely disruptive and moved large numbers of people and led to a lot of conflict, loss of life. So there is this way that people have actually managed to be able to survive or navigate these waves of political and economic and social instability and fragmentation.
Rose, you yourself possess firsthand experience in interviewing these locals. Can you tell us more about this sentiment Matthew describes? More of the story here of what happens when locals head-on face the interests of production and extraction of natural resources in their community?
Yeah, I think with my interviews in the communities last time, one community leader said she actually refused to show where the mineral is in that location within the town because she said some times back some external guys came in to extract the resource, but the community tried to stop them because it has happened several times that when such vital resources are extracted, the community doesn't benefit from it. So this time, both the community and the government authorities, I think, sometimes back met and discussed how these resources are very vital to the community. And if extracted in the right procedures, it may help the community to develop and may also pay back to the community. From the experiences so far, some of the youth within the community, most especially a resource like gold and other minerals, they have that deal with external investors who come and illegally or in partnership with some government officials, they handle the deal and only these few benefit from the resources, not the community at large. So that is the fear. And that's why the community has become vigilant on any activities regarding extraction of resources taking place in the community.
You'd mentioned that the community is thinking about how to share the resources with the community, but I don't understand that that's necessarily happened yet. Is that just the hope, or has that actually happened?
That is the hope that in the future, an investor may come and extract the resource in the right way, following the right procedures that can really help the community benefit from. So at the moment, I think there's not trust yet, and the resources are intact. So nothing is being done about it.
So if there is this blurred line between foreign investors who are primarily interested in maximizing profits at the least expense, and on the other side, government officials who are potentially seeking some sort of reward through such a transaction, is it even possible to determine whether the extraction of resource is compliant with the right procedures that you mentioned?
They are not yet clear, because a very long list of these natural resources, some are managed by the locals, very few are managed itself. There are different institutions or departments that govern the resources. You hear about revenue authority. Sometimes there is other ministries, Ministry of Forestry, and all these departments managing all these same resources, which to the community is somehow complex to understand, because they don't know exactly which procedure they can take, or how is it being done, or whether it is tax, or even if it is tax. At the moment, I think extraction of a resource like gold is, I think, on hold, or it is being done illegally or at a government level. But generally, some of these resources in the communities is suspended because the current extractive activities are not trusted. And the community has hoped that in the future, if things go well and the country is peaceful, the hope is maybe an investor may come who will really follow the right procedure that will involve the community leaders and elders. And at the end of the day, the community will be able to benefit from the resources that they will extract.
So, Rose, is it safe to say that this is actually a reaction to the perceived mismanagement of oil and other natural resources in South Sudan, that people are being cautious?
Sure. It has a background from how oil revenue is being managed. So people believe that the same may apply to non-oil resources. So there is that kind of confusion that actually complex. And remember, during the interviews, I talked to several people, community elders and other groups. They were like, okay, there are so many government departments or main institutions that manage the resources. So it wasn't very clear to the public whether all the departments that manage the resources are the right people, or there are those who are there for some reasons. So that caused that kind of mistrust, because the hope is that if all go well and peace return into the country, maybe the procedure may change and people will be able to understand what is going on around extraction and management of the resources. Because at the moment, things are complex for the community to understand.
And when you say it's complex, I understand that to mean that there's a lot of distrust about the government's intentions and distrust about which sides of government are actually the ones who should be managing resources, or whether it's people who are doing their best to get a hand in it so that way they could benefit from it and control it in some way, because they receive so little money from the government to pay their salaries that they're often looking for other ways that they can pay them.
And as you know, our civil servants stay for 4, 5, 6 months for them to receive their monthly salary. Their monthly salary, for instance, for 1 month, I don't know if I can say it's less than $5. So you can imagine, once the salary comes, it is spent in a day. Yeah, so you can imagine a kilo of meat is 4,000 SSP. That $5, if it buys a kilo of meat and other spices, you know, and transport, and it's just a budget for 1 day, or even less than 1 day, maybe half a day. So what do we expect? So that's why there's that distress around extraction of and management of resources, because communities believe that when the government fails to pay civil servants in time, and given the fact that the amount received is less, so there is a possibility of doing anything to sustain their families.
Yes, and my understanding from the research that you were part of is actually, and what I argue from as far as historic patterns have been taking place. So even before British-led occupation of Sudan and South Sudan in 1899, taxes were very predatory on people. And this continued after independence and into the civil war years, well into the CPA. So even with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005, people were still paying taxes that really just supplemented people's civil servant salaries rather than contributing to any type of public service. And instead of public services coming from tax revenue, they've actually come from, or even from oil revenue, they've been primarily funded by the international community. So by donors such as the UK, the US, the World Bank, and all these kind of things. So this speaks to the fear that other natural resources will essentially contribute to the same dynamics is a big reason why people have decided to be cautious with the government.
There's also a deeper layer that goes beyond the basic understanding of, let's say, the business or the operational side of things. Matthew, you cite in your research the idea of moral economy, which broadly refers to how people relate to natural resources, and that goes beyond the transactional logic of any marketplace. Could you elaborate some more on this for our listeners?
Myself and the co-authors of this paper, as well as the local research network, which the Bridge Network of South Sudanese researchers, are still in the process of articulating what we mean by moral economy. One of the main things that we mean is actually that it does challenge, or at least provides a narrative against the overarching political economy of one which is a very elite driven and very much about the co-optation of resources almost at any cost. And that includes human life, includes environmental protection, certainly includes protecting human rights and these kind of things. Whereas at the local level, you see a much more nuanced understanding of sort of actually identity at the local level being actually tied to their relationship to natural resources. So natural resources being the kind of most fundamental aspect of local economies, and not just local economies, but of community belief. I mean, in areas in Eastern Equatoria, communities really valued particular types of trees, which have a huge role in how communities navigate conflict, and it's sort of a space, it actually creates a space for dialogue and so forth. So it's not just about the idea that the kind of monetization of the natural world, it's actually a much more spiritual belief in some instances, or certainly one that encompasses more than just ruthless capitalist logic. Its value is something that we're exploring in our work at the moment, but there are lots of different vernacular terms around value. And because they're so rich, we're actually going to be focusing on this in our next round of research in the next year or so, where we actually devote a significant amount of attention to trying to understand and articulate what are the different moral economies that exist. Because it's not apparent that there's just one. Many of the examples that I'm providing are from the timber sector, which emerged as one of the most prominent this round of research. But there's going to be different ones that emerge for natural resources such as minerals, but also things like sand from rivers, which is used in construction and so forth, but also waterways and fishing. All of these different types of natural resources, of which that's just a few, have different ways that people relate to them.
I'd, of course, like to ask Rose a similar question. What are some of the examples you have witnessed when it comes to the perception of natural resources in South Sudanese communities and society more broadly?
So maybe one thing I can remember from those interviews is that across the participants I talked to, like the community chiefs, the women groups, the women leaders, and the youth leaders, there was that common belief that around extraction of some resources like gold and big trees are the source of rivers, across these participants, they had that one common perception that they know that before extraction of such resources, remember it is ancestral land, and the belief is that the ancestors endowed the land with these resources. And before any attempts to do with extraction, there is a need to appease the ancestors, their spirits, with sacrifices, where the slaughter goat or chicken or whatever at the site before they do any extraction. This is just to, you know, the belief is to help successful extraction of this kind of resources. I remember very well in my interviews, somebody said, look, where are our mangoes? See, because this issue of one of these resources like sand that the guys extract to make bricks, it has made, if you come to Yambio, some of the mango trees we used to see are no more there. So people are complaining that where are our mango trees? So because they cut the mango trees as firewood to burn the bricks. And last year, there was that campaign of you cut one tree down, you plant two more. So there was that kind of campaign to make sure that at least in the nearest future, we are able to have more trees to reforest the community.
Matthew, Rose, it is clear to me at this point that the shared understandings of South Sudanese people is often overlooked from a policy perspective. So let me play the role of a provocateur here and ask the straightforward question as to whether this can develop into something potentially more latent, something that mobilizes the people as A, the management of resources becomes less sustainable over time, and B, the resources themselves become more scarce.
Yes, I think, because it's true that some of the things that happen in the country are related to the management of resources. People have questions and questions that are unanswered. And now with the formation of, you know, through that project of community policing, communities are in a way empowered where they have their leaders from youth leaders. We have also have women leaders coming to the chief and sub-chief and headman. So right now, the community is more organized, and I think which has helped the community to at least organize themselves and ask some of these questions to the government. But I'm not sure how they are, you know, they approach it and how they go about it to make sure that the voice of the community reach the government concerned or the authority concerned so that they can get an answer to what they expect.
Yeah, I mean, this is a complicated question. So we're still in the midst of doing more research on this. And I think we have to be really careful when thinking about what the drivers are of conflict when it comes to natural resources. What we actually see is perhaps a bit more of a, there's a broader questions about what is the local community as the different natural resources become more important as the country is likely to decarbonize either by choice or just by circumstance as the world changes. So this means that different ideas of contested histories are going to come in, are certainly something that's emerging in our research as something that's coming into play, or certain ideas of who belongs there, what local forms of identity are emerging. And some of those are around ethnic or tribal identity, but they're not strictly about that. And these boundaries are quite blurred in ways that are not as made apparent when reporting on South Sudan is done. There's often a turn towards very rigid ethnic or identity claims, when actually we see in our work that things are really fluid and people are, there's intermarriage is relatively common. Movement of people is quite common, even, you know, especially with waves of conflict. So these are highly contested terms that are likely to remain contested, I could see, for some time, if not the foreseeable future. So the risk of conflict tied to that I think we have to be really careful in making those kind of crystal ball pronouncements, because what we actually see are more peaceful ways that people are navigating it and turn towards working together in a much more cooperative way against what is a really quite robust understanding that this elite political bargain, which privileges those who are close to the seat of power in Juba and is invested in the maintenance of its own existence almost at such an extreme and certainly often very violent, that people are searching for alternatives. So I wouldn't just say that business as usual is what people are after. If anything, our examples and these narratives that are emerging around how people relate to natural resources, which for now we are understanding as different moral economies, shows that there may actually be viable alternatives to the status quo, and people are certainly deeply hungry for that. But how it will manifest is still remains to be seen.
For now, that concludes today's premiering episode on local communities and resource extraction in South Sudan. We hope you found it informative and educational. You can find more information on the Conflict and Civicness Research Group page of the LSC website. There you will also find details on upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all of our publications. Do follow us on Twitter at LSC_CCRG, and see you next time.